Call the government operations meeting to order. We have a quorum.
Yes.
Representative Lean, do you have a chance to look at the minutes?
I have, Mr. Chair, and I do move them.
Motion's been made to move the minutes of Tuesday, February 19th, and Wednesday, February 20th. Any corrections or errors or corrections need to be noted? Otherwise, all in favor of passing the minutes as or approving the minutes as printed, say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? The minutes are approved. First thing on our agenda, I thought I had here, I guess I is taking back up House File 409. Representative Norton, here she comes. And I'll take the. You don't take off the pen. Just let it go, right? So, Representative Norton.
Hello, Mr. Chair and Committee.
I believe we were in questions before. Is and the bill's in front of us, so we don't have to move it again. It's already been moved. It just was laid over. Do we want to get right to the amendments then? And
Mr. Chair, yes, I had an A35 author's amendment.
Okay. I'm trying to find it here in my packet. Okay, there we go. There we go. So I'll move the A35 amendment. You want to explain what that does?
Yes, Mr. Chair. There was some discussion amongst committee members about the authority and the Medical Center Development Corporation and shining a light on the records and the audit. And so this particular amendment outlines that the money that the state will be providing to the community for economic development will be open to audit. So that's what this clarifies.
Any questions on the A35 amendment? Not. All in favor of the A35 amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
One nothing. Nothing.
Motion's approved. Amendments added. We have other amendments here.
And Mr. Chair, if I might. We had an oral amendment that also was in response to some of the comments heard from committee members that I would like to make.
Okay. State your amendment and we'll.
It's on page 6, line 11, after the word entity, insert the words in partnership with representatives of the city experienced in matters of planning, supporting, and administering development activities.
Can you repeat that?
I can.
Ms. Dyson, do you have that? Or?
No, Mr. Chair.
Okay, can you repeat that slowly so Ms. Dyson can get it down? Or?
There's a page. There's no page.
Want to repeat that again so we can
yes.
hear it?
On page 6, line 11, after the word entity, insert, in partnership with representatives of the city experienced in matters of planning, supporting, and administering development activities.
I'll move that amendment. Members, do we have any questions of what that amendment does? Can you explain what that amendment does, Representative?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We're trying to just clarify that the Medical Center Economic Development Corporation will be working cooperatively with the city, and so we were hoping that this language clarified that.
Members, any questions? If not, Ms. Dyson, do you have that?
Mr. Chair, we were provided with a written out copy, and I've provided it to the committee LA.
Okay. Any questions? If not, Representative Drazkowski.
Mr. Chair, I move the oral amendment.
Okay, Representative Drazkowski moves the oral amendment. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The amendment's adopted. Representative Pepin, you had the A9 amendment.
Yes, Mr. Chair, I'd like to move the A9 amendment.
Okay, Representative Norton, what's your pleasure on the A9 amendment?
Mr. Chair, we've reviewed the A9 amendment, and it states what we thought the bill said anyway and just clarifies it, so we're comfortable with that.
Representative Pepin, you want to explain exactly what it does? Or?
Yeah, thank you. It just, I wanted a little comfort language clarifying that the eminent domain authority would be used in the same way that's consistent with Chapter 117. For various reasons, that chapter is very clear on how eminent domain must be used, and I wanted to be clear that this wasn't a different, they weren't being held to a different standard. So I'd appreciate member support. Thank you.
Any questions about that, about the amendment? Any comments about the amendment? If not, all in favor of the A9 amendment, please say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Amendment's adopted. And we have other amendments here that... Okay, we got the A. I'll move the... I'll move the A10 amendment, and everyone's got that in front of them. And with the oral amendment we did, I'd like to delete line 1.2, or modify my amendment to delete line 1.2 out of the amendment. So it just the amendment would be 1.1 and then 1.3 through the end of it. Any questions about that amendment? Representative Pepin.
Mr. Chair, could you just explain it, what it does or what the point of it is?
I'll have Ms. Dyson explain it.
Mr. Chair and members, the A10 amendment is the combination of amendments that were presented to the committee at the last hearing and includes the modifications to the authority with the appointments by the mayor and the city council president. It's the same basic modifications that were made in the amendment that was presented before. That is on lines 1.3 through 3.15. Then on line 3.16, it's deleting section 11, which I believe is the section that relates to municipal tort liability, which the tort liability statute applies to all political subdivisions. The line 3.17 is the amendment that inserted the state auditor into the requirement for an audit, and that was an amendment that was a one-line amendment that was in front of the committee last time. Then 3.18 through the end of the amendment is the other amendment that was in front of the committee last time that modifies the determination of the value capture amount by the Commissioner of Revenue that's at the end of the bill that talks about how the value capture is determined and eliminates the role of this consultant and allows the commissioner to hire a consultant and pay for it from amounts that are attributable to the value capture amount.
So anyway, it was the amendment. It's combining three of the amendments that were in front of the committee last time.
Representative Pepin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Can you walk me through Section 11 again, the liability and contract or tort, and why we want to delete that? I don't know if that's a technical reason because they're, or if it's a choice of the author, or maybe you could just, somebody could explain why that is in here.
Ms. Dyson.
Mr. Chair, I would defer to the author and...
Representative Norton.
Mr. Chair and members, we did talk with, I was going to say representative, but Ms. Dyson, about removing this because it is already in current law. It was just restating what already has to happen by law because we're a public authority, so it was unnecessary. Part of that was, I think, as we were having the bill drafted originally, it was just taking out parts from other authorities and putting them in here, and I think it just wasn't needed. So perhaps counsel.
Mr. Chair and Representative Pepin, yes. That's a special tort provision.
Could you please identify yourself for the tape?
For the record, Mr. Chair, my name is Lynette Slater-Crandall, and I'm with the Dorsey & Whitney Law Firm. That special tort liability provision is part of Chapter 469 and applies to other similar economic development authorities such as port authorities. The general law in respect of tort liability for public entities, however, is certainly acceptable to the author, and so we have no concerns about having it removed. I don't believe that it was originally proposed by the author, but otherwise to the committee, but we have no concerns.
Representative Pepin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Ms. Crandall. And Ms. Dyson, is that your understanding that it's as well, that this is sort of just a repeat and not necessary?
Ms. Dyson.
Mr. Chair and Representative Pepin, the Chapter 466 is the Municipal Tort Liability Statute, and it applies to all political subdivisions. And this section of the bill, where am I? Here it is.
Section 11.
Yep. Starts by saying, subject to the provisions of Chapter 466, the authority is liable in contract and tort, and it goes on. So I don't know that it changes the substance of what the authority would be subject to if this section is removed. This section is copied from other provisions, as Ms. Crandall said. It's copied from other sections that are in Chapter 469. By taking it out, there won't be a section in the bill relating to specific like this to the authority, but Chapter 466 still applies.
Ms. Representative Pepin.
Thank you very much for the clarification, Mr. Chair. I'm just wondering, too, if the author of the amendment or author of the bill, could you just talk about lines 321 through 327? I saw that in the amendment a second ago. And pointed it out.
Mr. Chair, and I may have, you're talking about line 3.21 on the amendment.
Representative Norton. Representative Pepin, what that does is it basically, in the bill, the calculation of this goes to the private nonprofit. What this does is that the calculation of what the taxes and what those tax amounts goes to Department of Revenue. So it puts the Department of Revenue in charge of what those amounts are that the tax increment is going to be based off of.
Okay.
As opposed to the authority or the private nonprofit.
Thank you.
Representative O'Driscoll.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Norton, in the amendment in the A-10, in Section 7, which talks about the construction of the authority and its membership, I had suggested at the last hearing that since Mayo has, and at their own admission, a wide footprint of customers that are patients that they see across the state. We actually had a graphic on that we might want to look at putting a general member of the public not in the Rochester area to be able to look at some of the greater Minnesota interests on that or outside of the Rochester Mayo interests on that. And I see that the makeup of the board doesn't have that. Was that an oversight or a conscious decision to pass? And I'm just curious because it was one of the things that was important to me.
Representative Norton.
Chair Nelson and Representative O'Driscoll. Frankly, it just slipped my mind, but I do, on line 1.20, and I think I pointed this out last time, the governor does have the ability to appoint someone representing labor from, it does say, statewide labor organizations, and that isn't specific to our community. But I'm sorry, I just forgot.
And Representative O'Driscoll, this is the compilation of the amendments that we had before us, with fixing the technical, with the technical amendments to them, and that didn't get brought before us, but Representative O'Driscoll.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate the fact that organized labor statewide is going to have a seat at the table on this, but I'm also wondering if we couldn't have a general member of the public instead of that general member of the public having to be associated or affiliated with organized labor in the state of Minnesota.
Mr. Chair.
Representative North.
I mean, there's no reason that you couldn't offer an amendment to, when it has the governor appointee, he could appoint two residents, one from the city and one from greater Minnesota. I mean, that's something that the committee could do.
Representative O'Driscoll.
Well, Mr. Chair, if the author is willing to take that, I would work with her right now to, and Ms. Dyson, to craft something that would take one of those two Rochester City positions and make it one the city of Rochester and the second outside of Rochester or Olmsted County, something that would be a broader base within the state of Minnesota. I think that the Minnesotans will be served better by that because of the impact of Mayo and the patient base across the state.
So, Representative O'Driscoll, you're looking at line 1.19 where it says the governor, appointed by the governor, before that, make that two residents or two individuals, one from the city and one from outside the city, I guess is your intent?
I'm sorry, Mr. Chair, are you on the bill or are you on the amendment?
On the amendment.
And line what? Again, I'm
1.19 is what I'm looking at, and I guess I could ask Ms. Dyson for the best wording on that. Basically, we're adding an additional soul. I don't know if we have to change anything above with the total number on the board, but on 1.7, so we'd have to move on 1.7, strike 7 and put 8, and then in 1.19 have the governor appoint two people, one from the city and one from greater Minnesota. Ms. Dyson.
Mr. Chair, if you give me a minute, I'll write something out. But yes, on 1.7, you're correct. You'd have to change 7 to 8 voting members. And then on 1.19, it could say a resident of the city and a resident from, and then Representative Driscoll would have to identify if it's outside the city, outside the county, outside southeast Minnesota, what he would prefer.
Yeah, I'm not exactly sure what the geographic is. I know that we're talking about the same concept, but I don't know how to define that, if it's Olmsted County or if it's out of congressional city district or, you know, what it is. But I know that we want to have good public policy on that, and I guess I would defer to, I guess we'd say non-Rochester, non-Olmsted County resident, because that would cover the idea of outside of the physical footprint of Mayo, but would still be in the patient base of Mayo. I would defer to the author to see if that's acceptable, and we probably even modify that language as we get it. I just think it's important that we, because of the impact and the state's being asked to participate, that we keep the state as a whole at the table.
So, Representative O'Driscoll, if it just says non-Olmsted County, we wouldn't have to say city, because it would be redundant.
Correct, because Olmsted, or Rochester is included wholly within Olmsted County.
And Mr. Chair, to make it easier technically, if we just add it to line 6 as a separate, then we don't have to worry about the terms in the next, because it just applies to 6, so it would apply to both persons.
So it'd be only one, so we'd be adding one,
Mr. Chair. I'm just concerned that if we start doing too much, then we're going to start affecting the terms on the next page. So if we just add it to line 1.19, and
Representative Norton, Ms. Dyson has handed me a language here that says on line 1.19, a resident of the city and a resident from outside Olmsted County.
That sounds wonderful.
Does that sound, and then it'd be followed by appointed by the governor.
Mr. Chair, I'd move that oral amendment.
So Representative O'Driscoll moves an oral amendment of the A-10 amendment that on line 1.7 delete 7 and insert 8, and on line 1.19 delete a resident of the, no, after the comma, resident of the city, add before governor?
No.
I'll let Ms. Dyson do it.
Mr. Chair and members, the amendment on 1.19 would be after city, insert, and a resident from outside of Olmsted County.
Any questions on the amendment? Representative O'Driscoll?
I was just going to thank the author for the friendly amendment.
Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and to the author. I think we spend a lot of time on boards and commissions, and sometimes it's good to have an odd-numbered board because then you have a majority if there is a split decision. And the effect of this amendment would be to have an even-numbered board, which could lead to gridlock, potentially. So I am I'm less supportive of it just because I understand where Representative O'Driscoll is coming from, but I think when you have an even-numbered board, you can lead to some consequences by having gridlock if that potentially happens in a split board. So,
Representative O'Driscoll.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think Representative Hansen brings up an outstanding point, and maybe what we could do is move that from 8 to 9 and have two outside of Olmsted County to have even better representation, and our situation has been resolved, and we've enhanced the input from across the state.
Representative Hansen.
Well, maybe it's one from outside and then one from South St. Paul.
I was thinking more Stearns County, but I kind of like where you're going.
Yeah. Representative Pepin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and to the author, and this is somewhat to this amendment. I was kind of wondering about the makeup of the board as well. I don't know that I was thinking in the same direction as Representative O'Driscoll, but one thing I noticed was that you're having a representative from a statewide labor organization representing the building trades, and I was just wondering if you'd given any thought to having someone from a statewide business organization. And I know that there are a few representatives from the specific business entity, but it seems like if we're looking for expertise, that might be, instead of having two from outstate, perhaps one of them could be a business. And I don't want to screw your bill up here, but I'm just wondering if you'd give that consideration.
Representative Pep, or Representative Norton.
Well, thank you for that concept. I worked with folks to get the board the way it is, and that didn't come up in the conversation. We can certainly continue talking about that, and we do, as you're mentioning, if you pass this amendment, we'll come out with an even number, and perhaps that's something we could add to balance it so that we get back to address Representative Hansen's concern.
Representative Pepin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Norton. Okay, well, let's talk about it, because I think that the benefit of having someone from a statewide business organization as opposed to just having a few from the specific business entity is that, as to the point that Representative Driscoll was making, we're wanting to look at the impact of the whole state. They might have a slightly different perspective of what this means statewide. So I won't introduce anything now, but perhaps later we can look at that.
Thank you.
Representative Druskowski, do you have a question on the amendment, or okay? If any more questions on the amendment, if not, all in favors of the amendment, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
Motion passes. That's the amendment to the amendment. Any more questions on the amendment as amended? Representative Druskowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, I've got a question on line 3.17 of the amendment. And that amends line 10.6 on the bill, inserts the state auditor, and it appears to me to look to employ the state auditor as an independent contractor. And I don't know how to approach this question. Maybe Ms. Dyson can weigh in, but I'm curious and maybe initially concerned about whether we're putting the state auditor and her office in this case in a dilemma in terms of their ability to act as in their role of as a state auditor, and a conflict that could exist if they were actually employed by this municipality.
Ms. Dyson. Representative Norton.
Mr. Chair and Representative Druskowski, this actually came from the state auditor. It was her insertion, not to to mandate it, but to put it as an option. And apparently this is something her department is doing throughout the legislative process, is just putting herself as an option, her office as an option, not her personally. But it isn't a mandate. It's just an option.
Representative Druskowski.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Norton. But, you know, and I understand that, and I've seen that in other places, but I'm concerned about whether we're putting that office in a difficult position should this not municipality, the wrong term, political subdivision, be in a position in which they are to both be potentially audited by the state auditor, while the state auditor is also receiving money from this political subdivision as a contractor. So I guess my question for Ms. Dyson would be, do we do this anywhere else in statute, and is there anything in statute that could raise some red flags about us doing this?
Ms. Dyson.
Mr. Chair, I would actually defer to the Office of the State Auditor, and I believe they are here to speak to this portion of the amendment, because I'd have to do some looking to see how else it's worded in the statutes, but I believe the General Counsel for the State Auditor's Office is here.
Please identify yourself for the tape. And
my name is Mark Kerr. I'm Assistant Legal Counsel for the Office of the State Auditor. And this is really based on trying to make the first two sentences of the audit subdivision consistent with one another. The first one says that this entity should be in the same position as the city, and the city right now has an option of either going with a CPA or having our office do the audit. And we've used language that is used throughout Chapter 412 for regular cities, and also in 471.
And Mr. Kerr, to Representative Druskowski's question about conflict of interest, because you're charging them for this audit, don't you charge back people for any audits that you do around the state, counties, cities?
Right. Under Chapter 6, we would charge the actual cost of an audit if they did choose us to do their audit. But they have the option of choosing a CPA or us.
So, Mr. Kerr, this is no different than any other
audit. Under 412, yeah.
Thank you, Mr. Kerr. Representative Druskowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Kerr.
Thank you.
Any other questions regarding the A-10 amendment as amended? If not, all in favor of the A-10 amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The A-10 amendment is adopted. Representative Winkler, of the other amendments, is there one that you'd like to do?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like to move adoption of the A-11 amendment.
The A-11 amendment is before us. Can you explain what that does?
Sure. Mr. Chair and members, the A-11 does several things. It provides in lines 1.2 through 1.5 for an audit of the development corporation. Lines 1.6 through 1.13 essentially take out the requirement that the authority contract with the Medical Center Economic Development Corporation, turn that into a may, so that they can exercise their own independent judgment in that regard. And lines 1.15 through 1.21 make clear that the Economic Development Corporation are subject to conflict of interest law and gift ban law, as well as public data related to their work. Now, I understand that there is some concern about that, but general rule on government data, public data, is that you have to create the exception to the rule, not that you have a blanket exception. So the idea here is that you put the burden back on the corporation to come up with the reasons why, or the specific things that need to be non-public. So, members, I think this, you know, the way this bill is put together, it creates an authority, but it essentially requires the authority to work directly with the Mayo Clinic and kind of embeds them together. The goal of this amendment is to make that decision a discretionary one on the part of the authority, as well as to make sure that the basic state sunshine laws apply to any corporation that is engaged by the authority for that work.
Representative O'Driscoll.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To Representative Winkler's amendment, are we also suggesting, or I don't think you specifically talk about it, but are you having any concerns about disclosure from what other elected officials or other appointees have as it relates to the campaign finance board disclosures, conflicts of interest and things? Is that what you're thinking about with this, or does that solve the issue, or does that just complicate the issue that you're trying to look at here?
Representative Winkler.
Mr. Chair, Representative O'Driscoll, your question complicates it because I don't understand it exactly, but it's not about the campaign finance board. It is about gifts to public officials, and it's about conflicts of interest in voting. So it's basically just applying the same kind of sunshine laws that we have for any other public official to this nonprofit corporation that is acting in a quasi-public capacity.
Representative O'Driscoll.
Well, Representative Winkler, part of my last comments were thoughts that were being generated. You and I both sat on the Elections Committee, and you know that that's something that we're looking at, and there's a list of other quasi-government agencies and committees and things that are on here. I'm wondering if that problem that you're looking at is in addition to or is a separate issue, if you have any concerns, that those members of this board should also be included as a part of those who make those disclosures.
Representative Winkler.
Well, Mr. Chair, Representative O'Driscoll, so far as I know, the Mayo Clinic is not intending to run an election to see who gets to be on the Nonprofit Development Corporation Board. So those issues shouldn't apply. And generally speaking, those campaign finance disclosure rules apply to state officials and perhaps to county commissioners and judges, but not to local city officials. Those are governed at the and registered at the city level.
Representative O'Driscoll.
Again, just asking for clarification since it's something that we're undertaking in another committee that may expand its reach depending upon what the Elections Commission and the legislature does.
Representative Druskowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would just ask Representative Winkler, I'm looking at the amendment. I'm wondering about the wording, Representative Winkler. In line 1.4, should corporation there be plural?
Representative Winkler.
Mr. Chair, Representative Druskowski, I think I would incorporate an S in the word corporation on line 1.4 into my amendment to make that corporations. Or the? All right, Mr. Chair, I withdraw my incorporation, and on line 1.4, for the word corporation, insert the. And I don't think we need to vote on it. That's just something I'd incorporate into my amendment.
So get this straight. On 1.14, after between of and corporation, put the word the. And Representative Winkler incorporates that into his amendment. Representative Druskowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would just ask Representative Winkler if he'd accept one more incorporation. I would like to see the language strengthened around the limits of this audit and would ask if the representative would be interested in, on the very end of line 1.4, inserting the two words and limited. So it would read that are related and limited to any work the corporation performs for the authority.
You know, Mr. Chair, Representative Druskowski, I'm not sure that that does what you want it to do, but I think it might be better to hear from Representative Norton about this whole amendment before we start fine-tuning it.
Representative Norton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. In speaking, we did have this ahead of time, and we have looked it over. And I think we feel that the A35 amendment has dealt with a good part of this, and that a lot of this isn't necessary any longer, and in particular have concerns with 120, line 1.20 and 1.21. And I would like our testifiers to be able to address the whys of that, if you wouldn't mind.
Ms. Crandall.
Mr. Chair and Representative Winkler, As Representative Norton stated, it really is our intent to address the issues that I think you're trying to get at here, Representative Winkler. I just want to make it absolutely clear that the authority, the public body, and only our public body, is the entity that approves the development plan, that selects the projects that get financed, that spends every penny of the public funds. What this nonprofit development corporation does, working in partnership with the city, is to serve in an advisory capacity to provide the expertise that's necessary to establish the state as a destination medical center. So any public funding that would actually flow to the authority, to this nonprofit, would simply be as a contract for services. Similar, Representative Winkler, to a situation where your city may decide to establish a TIF district and engage a municipal financial advisor and have a contract for services to help develop a redevelopment plan to select projects and establish the district and identify qualified projects. So that's really all we're doing here. And we've clearly made it, we've actually added our own audit feature, and that's in Subdivision 9, Contracts for Services, in the 839, and that begins on line 1.14, I believe, Representative Winkler.
It's the 835 numbers.
And so what we provide there is that if there is a contract for services with the nonprofit, which we presume there would be, it's not specified what dollar amount that may be or anything of that nature, but then the state auditor would be able to follow those public dollars and ensure that they're spending compliance both with this law and with contract provisions. So with that, we would hope that we would address your concerns and you'd be willing to accept the A35.
Representative Winkler.
Well, Mr. Chair, Representative Norton, I certainly accept the A35. I just don't think it goes quite far enough. And specifically, members, I would advise you or suggest you might want to look at page 13 of the bill, lines 13.32 to 13.35, page 13 at the end. It says the authority shall engage a medical center economic development corporation to advise. And medical center economic development corporation is defined to be a nonprofit corporation formed by the Mayo Clinic. So there isn't any discretion on the part of the authority about who they can hire or whether they should engage this particular authority. So that in that way, it is different from an ordinary authority's ability to hire a consultant. It's mandatory. And then and the audit language in the 835 amendment is limited to that the nature and extent of the services furnished pursuant to the contract and that the payment complies with state law. So that audit is fairly limited for that corporation. What we're really doing is kind of creating a special nonprofit corporation with kind of all the benefits of being private and all the and creeping into the authority of being public in the sense that it is required that the authority engage with that nonprofit. So we're kind of blurring the lines between those two things. And I'm not saying that the A11 is the be-all, end-all amendment. In fact, I think there are some moving parts here that don't necessarily align all that well with the A35. But generally speaking, I think it's not reasonable that you kind of blur the lines like that. We have to maintain the difference between public and private entities. And generally speaking, we have to have a contract and a process for procurement in order to contract and spend public money on a private entity. So I guess I think the A11 goes in quite a ways in that direction. If there are sections of the A11 that you think are particularly problematic, I think it'd be fine to drop that. But we're creating a potentially conflicted situation by doing it this way, and I just have a concern about the amount of money and the way that these two things are embedded together.
Representative Norton.
Mr. Chair, I wondered if we could have a representative from Hames, who's worked on this, talk a little bit about the 1.20 and 1.21, which is particularly problematic, and why we may not want the sunshine laws and the broad opening of books in this economic development entity.
Mr. Haynes, please state your name for the tape again. And
members of the committee, my name is Bob Dunn, president of the Hammes Company. As Representative Norton said, we've been working with the Mayo Clinic on this initiative for quite some time. certainly the issues, Representative Winkler, that you're bringing up, we've given considerable thought and attention to. And I would first start by saying what we have tried to do and what's been described this morning is to put together a structure where all elements of control are placed with the authority. And while we describe that as being the authority to approve the development plan, the authority to approve how all funds are spent, those are normally the elements of control in an economic development effort like this where most attention is centered. But it goes beyond that here, and it goes considerably beyond that because of the fact that anything that is done by the Economic Development Corporation has to also be approved by way of contract by the authority. So any responsibilities, any dollars that flow from the authority down to the Economic Development Corporation, any authorization to do work that is given to the Economic Development Corporation can only occur once approved by the authority. And we haven't talked much about that, but the contractual control that the authority has over the EDC gives it absolute control over anything done within the EDC. So if there's something that is brought forth by the EDC that the authority does not agree with in a public setting, that's where it stops. So all control is vested with the authority. Beyond that, as it relates to the specific line items that Representative Norton mentioned, I believe it's 120 and 121, where we've spent a good deal of our time in putting the structure together is to concentrate on what are the things that we will have to be able to do to successfully bring forward businesses that will make the investment in the district that will cause us to generate the tax base that we're looking for. And there's a wide array of examples that I could give you, but what we don't want to do is have a structure where the Economic Development Corporation is trying to work with and entice private business to make an investment in this district, and because of the structure of how we must operate, that we're not able to effectively draw those businesses in. For instance, we talked about this last week. If we are negotiating with a major corporation who may want to bring 1,000 jobs to Rochester, oftentimes we have to operate under a confidentiality agreement because we're competing against other communities. And we have to be able to negotiate the terms of our participation in terms of what we might do financially to bring that business to Rochester. If we have to do that with full disclosure and in a public setting, it can certainly be done that way, but I think we will greatly reduce the number of businesses that we can entice to want to come and invest within this district. Beyond that, probably our greatest concern has to do with the fact that we believe there's opportunity to draw in significant private investment, meaning benefactor investment, and to the extent that we have to disclose publicly who those benefactors might be, the terms of their giving, the context of how we put that kind of participation together, again, I think we will greatly diminish the chances of our bringing in substantial private capital for investment in the DMC. So for a variety of reasons, what we've tried to do is address the concerns of control and give you absolute control at the authority, but to structure the EDC to work in partnership with the city to allow it to be effective in drawing the private investment into the district.
Representative Winkler.
And Mr. Chair, Mr. Dunn, I don't think we can draft language as we sit here that would do that, but I think that your point about confidentiality and business negotiations is a good one, as well as the confidentiality of donors who may not want to be identified or have their terms disclosed, and that's exactly the kind of exception we should build into this. But the way we should do it is by not creating a blanket exception, but by calling out specific types of arrangements that you think deserve confidentiality or require confidentiality and write that into the bill rather than saying that none of the sunshine laws apply. So for that, I don't think we can do it now, but I just wonder if you would be open to, instead of having a blanket exemption, having a list of exemptions that are specific.
Mr. Dunn.
Mr. Chair, Representative Winkler, I certainly think that's something that we can work on. It would take some thought. We've spent a lot of time looking at how to structure this so that we can accomplish the most important task, which is to give control to the authority. But I certainly think there are ways that we can continue to evaluate how to structure this so that the interests of all parties are properly addressed.
Representative Winkler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And so if we could continue to work on that, I'd be willing to strike lines 1.20 and 1.21 from the A11. And then I wonder if there are anything else in this A11 that are particularly troublesome. Because I do have the same concern. It does, the authority has final decision making, but it is required to consult with a nonprofit formed by Mayo Clinic. And there's no discretion in that decision making whatsoever.
And Mr. Chair, Representative Winkler, I do know that the mandate is there, again, to get the party in the room, to be quite honest, who has the best ability to help Minnesota meet the goal that's set forth in this bill. But I do note that there's certainly no restriction, and actually I would be surprised if the authority wouldn't contract with many other parties who would bring expertise. So I would presume that an independent municipal financial advisor would be involved. There will be legal counsel. There will be many, many seats at the table to ensure that this lofty goal is attained. And so while that language is mandatory, it's certainly not restricting the authority's ability to consider all informed opinions and, as Mr. Dunn pointed out, make the final judgment. As you know, of course, a political subdivision in the state of Minnesota can't unlawfully delegate its power, its decision-making power, to a private entity, and that's certainly not our intent here.
So, Representative Winkler.
So, Mr. Chair, then I would also incorporate another modification, which is to strike lines 1.20 and 1.21.
And then with the note that you'll continue working with them to try and come up with reasonable restrictions?
That's correct, Mr. Chair.
Representative Norton.
Mr. Chair, my preference would be that we withdraw the whole A11 and work on this a little bit more. And as you heard, certainly we are interested in doing that. And I ask that because it does, I think we have done the A35 already, and it does address some of it. And I would like to spend a little bit more time making certain that we're not being duplicative and that we're not putting layer upon layer. So I guess from the position of the authors of the bill, we'd prefer that you not support the A11 at this time. But while I know we don't want to say any longer that we will work behind the scenes, I will work behind the scenes with you, Representative Winkler.
Representative Winkler.
Mr. Chair and Representative Dorn, I guess I am open to that because, you know, we don't want to just sort of do ad hoc working committee.
Right.
So where would we do this if this bill gets another hearing in another committee? Where would we take that up?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Norton.
I believe this bill is going to taxes, and so between now and its tax committee hearing, we could pull a group of people together, anyone here that might be interested, willing to come sit down and have input into that.
Representative Winkler.
Mr. Chair and Representative Norton, I will withdraw the A11 amendment, but I, there are two things in here that are important. Number one, there is a mandate to form a particular kind of relationship with a particular entity that is not subject to conflicts of interest, gift ban, and other protections, including data privacy or data practices. And I don't think we can have it both ways. So we either have to be it either is contracting with a public entity or a private entity, and we have to decide which one it's going to be.
Representative Pepin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Winkler. I'm not sure if this is the time to withdraw it. I'd actually prefer to deal with it in committee because there's not really a way to deal with such things on the floor, as we found. And as far as going to taxes, the tax chair is very, very strict on what can be discussed in tax committee, and I don't know that she would be open to such an amendment in tax committee. So, you know, I guess I'd like to work on this issue here, unless there's another committee after tax that this is going on that it would be appropriate, because I just don't think that Chair Lincheski is going to be open to this in tax committee.
Representative Winkler.
Well, Mr. Chair, Representative Pepin, I have a feeling that Representative Lincheski will be more than happy to hear anybody who wants to make changes to this bill.
So the amendment's been withdrawn. Are there further amendments that we need to take up? I think most of these from the other night have been incorporated into the ones that we've taken up. Any further questions on the bill? If not, I'll change my motion. sheet here. It's got to go to taxes. So I moved that the bill, I changed my motion, the bill be passed as amended and re-referred to taxes. All in favor of that amendment, of that bill? Motion, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
Bill's passed. Congratulations.
Thank you, Mr. Chair,
and good luck.
And committee for your patience.
Yeah, I had it under. And the next bill on the committee is House File 322, Representative Erickson. Do I see Representative Erickson? Oh, okay. That's right. That's. I was thinking of Sandra.
I'm the better looking representative.
Representative Sandra Erickson will not be happy with that comment.
We probably disagree on several things, probably.
Let me get the copy of the bill. Looking at me, you can't add. Yeah. House File 322. Representative Erickson, please explain your bill. I'll make a motion that, where does this got to go? To I move the House File 322 be recommended to pass and move to Natural Resources, Environment, Natural Resources, and Agricultural Finance. Representative Erickson, please explain your bill.
Thank you, Chairman Nelson. This is a bill to extend the Minnesota Agricultural Education Leadership Council. It is a group that's comprised of all the different entities to promote agricultural education across the state. This has been brought up three or four times to be renewed, and we're just asking that it be renewed. I think it's 5 years on the bill, which is kind of the normal that it's been. And I do have a couple of people that can help me answer questions, Mr. Jerry Schoenfeld and Dr. Kesha Henry, if they would come up. I believe we have one person has expressed some interest in some questions. So I guess I'll turn it over to questions.
Any questions on the bill? There we go. Too much paper here. Any questions on the bill? Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Erickson. It's a very thick and comprehensive bill, lots of lines there. It's taking me a little while to get through it. But I did have a question for Mr. Schoenfeld or the doctor here on. So this is a somewhat mature council. We've reauthorized it a few times. I'm wondering, I went back and I looked at the goals of it and the requirements, and it talks about reporting. I'm wondering if there's been any kind of post hoc evaluation done of folks who received support from the program. Has maybe going back 5 years after they've got a grant for post-secondary, or just looking at their job success, or do you understand what I'm saying? Trying to look at
Mr. Schoen, please identify yourself for the tape and
sorry, Mr. Chairman,
and then you can answer.
Mr. Chairman, my name is Jerry Schoenfeld, and I work with the Minnesota Association of Agricultural Educators and have been around since the inception of this bill. And so, Dr. Henry, I think though maybe I'm at a bit of a loss here, Mr. Chairman, Representative Hansen, in the sense that I know that ad hoc way that we have reports coming back all the time, as I believe you may have been in the Agriculture Policy Committee, and a lot of discussion about results by individual instructors. But I think there is a formal review as well. Dr. Henry, could you help me out on that?
Please identify yourself for the tape and then can answer the question.
Mr. Chairman, my name is Kesha Henry, and I serve as the Executive Director for the Minnesota Agriculture Leadership Council. We have worked with several secondary schools across the state, as well as community groups and other organizations in providing funding for grants and scholarship programs. Today, we have provided over $2.7 million in grants. We have provided over $346,000 in scholarships. We have seen a lot of great results in our students taking on teaching profession. One of the problems that we face here in Minnesota is the shortage of agricultural science teachers. And we have developed programs specifically to increase the number of students taking on teaching careers. And we have seen some results in that. In terms of our grants program, we have worked with several schools in developing technology as well as curriculum. We have helped with the science, making science, agricultural science contributes towards graduation. So we're definitely seeing results in the programs that we're providing and the support system that we're providing for schools and ag education.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hansen, to try and zero in a little more on your specific question, there is a peer review that's done by the grants committees. So they do review when it comes back in terms of seeing what kind of outcomes that they have gotten from the individual schools have to report back to that committee as to what they've accomplished. But we're at a little bit of a loss here, Mr. Chairman, simply because Dr. Henry is fairly new to her position, so she doesn't have all the history probably in some of that. And I kind of work on the side a bit too, but we could get some more information as to the specifics in terms of outcomes. We certainly report every year. We've had people back ahead of the Agricultural Policy Committee and report about specific outcomes of individual instructors. And we've shared that with you, I think, in the first policy committee. But in terms of a formal report, a written formal report, I think we could probably bring more information about that to you in terms of the peer review process that goes through the grant program.
Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think that's good. I'm looking at, you know, do we have numbers on graduation rates of people have gone through the program, and then to look, you know, if you've had somebody that went through the program 10 years ago, are they employed in the field where they receive the grant? I mean, and I know that's hard to do, and I know you've got limited money, but if we had even some case studies of, and I support the program, but just.
Mr. Schoenfield.
Well, Mr. Chairman, let me give you some specifics as to some particular pieces that we could respond to. One of the reasons that this MLC council was put together was because we had a very diminished number in 1997, a very diminished number of graduates at the University of Minnesota itself. And quite frankly, the University of Minnesota had kind of taken a position to get rid of the ag ed program at that time. We had a one halftime instructor at that time, and we had six graduates. Now, put that in context, there are 196 ag ed programs around the state. And in addition to that, there are 57 farm business management programs, plus a number of post-secondary programs in the community colleges and the University of Minnesota itself with four-year degree. So six graduates are not going to keep the program going. And that was really what initiated this council. Today, however, to give you specific numbers as an example, we have 93 undergraduates at the University of Minnesota. We have 30 graduate students. There are 15 students going out this spring on for student teaching. And so those are the kind of numbers that we've seen in starting with this. And how did that come about? It came about because of the efforts of MLC in a number of ways. First of all, MLC put together a recruiter to go out into the high schools and recruit people and make them aware of some of the ag education opportunities. Because one of the things that had occurred was that the general counselors that are in most of the high school programs don't know much about agricultural education and therefore don't generally promote it. Secondly, they did start a scholarship program to provide scholarships. And the thing that's unique about this particular program, I might point out, is the fact that those scholarships are available in a 2+2 kind of a system. One of the additional things that was done was to put together work with the University of Minnesota and MNSCU to try and create what's called a 2+2 system, where rural students would be able to start in a community college, say at Ridgewater, at Wilmer, or at Riverland in southern Minnesota, and take their first 2 years there and their last 2 years at the University of Minnesota. And as part of that, there's a scholarship program that comes through here that provides not only money for the University of Minnesota, but for those transfer students and working with food. And that's pretty unique because you don't usually be, aren't usually able to cross between two systems. Thirdly, they also help with the transfer of from the College of Education on the Minneapolis campus to the College of Agriculture, which aided in providing a better place for it to be in order to expand agricultural education. Beyond that, we did something else, and that was that they established two mentoring programs. One of the problems, as you pointed out, is 10 years from then, who is left? And agricultural education, agribusiness, really tends to take people out of ag education because they can provide higher wages than the education system, and they provide opportunities in agribusiness. So one of the things that was established through here was the mentoring program. They're called TIP and PEP, and they are professional mentoring to help people maintain themselves in the teaching profession. But that's just one particular problem that, and MLC has done much more in a much broader array of things that I could go into, but we did kind of do that in the Ag Policy Committee, so I don't know if you want any more.
Representative Hansen. Any other questions of the, on the bill? Representative Falk.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And to any of the testifiers, I know that I think we've kind of figured out, you know, broad kinds of agriculture, traditional agriculture fairly well, but there's a bunch of new developments that we're seeing. So what's being done to reach out to train people who are coming up in some of these less conventional forms of agriculture, or if we have a number of immigrant communities coming to the state, what are we doing to go and make sure that this program is talking to them as well as what we consider to be the traditional avenues for agriculture?
Mr. Schoenfield, if you can be short.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Falk, I would point out, for instance, one of the things that was done a couple of years ago was to add somebody from the Minnesota Private College Councils as a member of this organization, which may not you may not think directly, but speaks to that. But what it does is bring in a group of people that have not traditionally been part of the agricultural education kind of group, which has traditionally been in the public area. In terms of the specific, for instance, reaching out to, there have been grants programs that have, for instance, in the Agricultural Committee, one of the programs that was talked about was the Farm to School program that was initiated through about a $7,000 grant coming from MLC that went to a particular high school, and they were able to create basically dealing with organics and some of the other gardening kind of issues where they were able to create a two-acre garden, teach cash flow principles and entrepreneurship and so forth, but also provide food for the school, which is a bit of a non-traditional spot in the more direct marketing of agricultural products from areas.
Representative
there have also
Falk.
Been, Mr. Chairman, even grants in the past have gone to such places as Hamline University to deal with agricultural literacy in a non-traditional context. So there have been a number of these things.
And Representative Falk, we've got two more bills we need to take up, so if we can keep the the questions and the answers short.
Yeah, have you looked at working with any of the alternative learning centers?
Mr. Chairman, I'm not aware, and I don't know if Dr. Henry would be.
Representative Schoenfield, Dr. Henry?
Find out.
Okay. Look into that.
Any further questions on the bill? If not, I renew my motion that. I renew my motion that House File 322 be recommended to pass and re-referred to Environment, Natural Resources, and Agricultural Finance Committee. All in favor of the motion, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? The motion passes. The bill is moved on. Congratulations. And we're House File 651, House File 653, Representative Quam is next on our agenda. And there's an amendment that wasn't in the packet that we're going to get, so if you can explain your bill. I'll move that House File 653 be recommended to pass and placed on the general register. Representative Quam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I don't believe I've seen that amendment. Basically, this bill.
Oh, is it for six, Representative Pepin, is that the amendment for 651 or these? Okay, never mind. It's 653. I misspoke. The amendment's for 651.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. There's twofold things on this, the reason for this bill. One is the fact that we need to update some of the open meeting to take into account the social media. The other is communication. And we, part of the problem we have is being able to communicate to especially school boards. Many of the parents are of the generation where social media and the network are huge. That's where they go first. And we need to allow for public bodies to communicate and utilize that to be in touch and keep the people informed, but avoid the accidental having a quorum present in a town hall meeting over the net that's on something not relational to the board. And the intent is, if it is a entity driven event, that they would call it like any other meeting. But we want to get an exemption if three members decide or four members decide to partake in a town hall meeting on health care or transportation. Thank you.
I see you have some people here who would like to speak on the bill. Please identify yourself for the tape and proceed with testimony.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Ken Sewell. I'm general counsel at the Minnesota Association of Townships. With me today, I have Janelle Cooper from Bridgewater Township and Gary Peterson, our executive director. And if it's okay with the committee, excuse me, we'd like to have Janelle start with some very brief testimony, then Mr. Peterson, and then I'll wrap up.
Keep it brief. Get moving along here. Yep.
Yes. Good morning, Mr. Chair.
Identify yourself for the tape. And
yes, sir. Yeah, I'm Janelle Cooper. I am clerk of Bridgewater Township and co-originator of this idea. We took it through the Minnesota Association of Townships legislative and research process. And so anyway, and just so a note, Bridgewater Township is in Rice County, and it's adjacent to the city of Northfield and the little city of Dundas. And the comment the idea that we had behind this as we were working this idea is that online tools of communication are not going away. I mean, it's a part of all of it. It's a part of culture and everything else that we do. And I believe that this bill will enhance, public participation in our processes, in our government processes. And we feel very strongly, we are not replacing, the regular meeting and what goes on in our regular, like in our case, a town board meeting. But we want to be able to draw as much input from our citizens as possible, and online is such a can be properly used to do such a thing. And I feel very strongly that this bill is a good first step, in establishing, how we can properly do this. And I'm very confident in Matt that that they can start this process and lead us through it.
Welcome to the committee, and please identify yourself for the tape.
Good morning, Mr. Chair. Thank you for having us, committee members. I'm Gary Peterson, Executive Director of the Minnesota Association of Townships. When this came forward as a resolution through our committee, we recognize as social media becomes more and more important, not only to our generation, but to the next generation, and how are we going to deal with it as far as meetings in the future. I think it's time that we do recognize the outlets that are out there, the Twitters, the Facebooks, all this type of thing, for conversation about topics that may come up to our committees and our town boards. We are not trying to replace meetings. What needs to happen at the meeting still needs to happen at the meeting. But we think that this can be a very enhancing area for our members to take input from people that maybe normally don't attend the meetings. Thank you.
Mr. Sewell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. As you've heard, what we are trying to do is establish a process to enhance public participation, to enhance public input. And in fact, if you look at line 1.13 of the bill, it specifically states that participation is to augment traditional communication methods, not to replace, not to be a substitute for, and not to conduct the meeting online. But if you right now under current law, if you've got a situation where, say, on Twitter, a resident post a comment about a proposed action, whether it be city, town, county, school, whatever. And the first supervisor, in our case, posts a response. The second supervisor can't respond because you'd have a quorum discussing that issue, and therefore everybody's opinion is being based on one input. And that's a dangerous precedent to set. So we want to be able to have the ability not to conduct a meeting, but to be able to engage the public with dialogue to augment those traditional methods. Going a little further down in the bill, it makes it very clear on line 1.16 and 17 that these have to be the public parts of a website. It can't be the private invite only, you know, chat rooms. This has to be the public portion, things that the general public has access to, where there is no protection. Line 1.18 specifically states it does not replace required public meetings and hearings, and specifically states that no vote may be taken online. This is language that we inserted this year. This bill actually was introduced a year ago. I told the media folks at the first day of session that we were bringing it back. As soon as we had language available, we made it available to them as well. I know that they have concerns. I had a very good conversation with Mr. Anfinson yesterday. But again, we don't believe this opens up the process to conducting a meeting online. This has to be to supplement traditional communications and actually enhance public participation. We certainly would be welcome if people have language they think would make it even more clear. We're certainly open to suggestions and ideas, but that's, we think the bill is very tight and geared towards enhancing that public input, particularly for the younger generation as we try to enhance and encourage new leaders to take over on our boards. This is the form of communications that they are used to, and we really need to allow that participation to make better public input. With that, we'll stand for questions.
Any questions of the committee? And Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And for me, the key is on line 1.14 and through 1.17. And my understanding of, I don't want to use the township example, I'd rather use like a five-member city council. And right now you cannot have one counselor say, I'm going to vote this way, and call another counselor who then calls another counselor and then calls another counselor and says they're going to do that. Right now I think that's prohibited under law of violating a quorum. And my worry would be that what I think you're allowing is somebody could text and say, I'm voting this way, and text another person and text another person. Or they do a Facebook messaging, I'm voting this way, and sending that to one of the other counselors. And that, I think, would, I think that'd be a problem. I think where you're coming from is trying to say that the public can engage via texting or Twitter or Facebook, but the serial lining up of votes or determining an outcome, I'm not quite sure. Maybe you can give me some reassurance that 1.14 through 1.17 does that, because
Mr. Sula.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hansen, I think in regards to like the tech, that would not be open to the general public, so that would not be protected under this provision. It has to be a posting and on the Facebook, and I, let me make it very clear, I am not a social media expert. I sent my third posting to Facebook today. I don't understand the inner workings, but we made it very clear. Ms. Dyson and I did a lot of research a year ago on this issue and trying to make it very clear that it has to be the open portion. Twitter, where everybody is open to follow. If you post, hey, here's my intent and here's why, we see that as a positive thing because it allows the public to then respond and say, wait a minute, have you thought about this point of view? Have you thought about this concern? It's not always feasible for people to make the public meeting. We're not, again, it physically says it doesn't replace the meeting, but this is just one more avenue that allows them to have the input that if they're doing the right thing, the board members then come back, whether it be a city council, county commission, school board, town board, they come back with that input to have enhanced discussion at their public meeting.
Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. But if we had three of the five posts that they're going to vote this way, then you've got an indication of the conclusion if they're all in one in alignment. And that's the without the that could be without the public meeting. That's my concern. Maybe Ms. Dyson can help with clarifying what's public and what isn't, because I just worry that this, even with how you have it written, can allow for lining up votes away from the public at a different intent than making the public be able to access their elected officials.
Representative Kwan.
What I'm hearing, Mr. Chair, is away from the public, away from the public. This specifically set up to be publicly accessible. I would say if a newspaper interviewed members on the committee, and I know with the stadium issue, they interviewed members on the committee, and if they independently brought up that X number were voting for it, and they put that in an article, which is conceivable, that would be out in the public, and that would not be, I think, a violation of the law. But again, all of this is for public discussion, and only the only thing is if it's public. If it's non-public or a secure communication, texting as opposed to tweets, you would not have an exemption.
Representative Hansen. Any other further questions on the bill? Representative Freiberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, the way I read this, it wouldn't apply to private Facebook messages or to texts, because it does say it has to be generally open to public participation, and it uses the term social media forum, and to me that says a public place. I mean, I'm just kind of glad to see you're working on this issue. I was on the city council for 9 years, and this was something we talked about. It got pretty good, can we just post on Facebook that there's going to be this public meeting happening, and what happens if one of the or two of the council members responds? Then do we have, and we had a lot more meetings with our city attorney about what we can do, and then we ended up, and then pretty much every time the answer ended up being, oh, I don't know. So I do think as these things become more common, and as you get younger people elected to local offices, it's becoming an issue. I'm glad to see this is here, and I'm certainly supportive of it.
Mr. Chair, if I may, just one last comment. I realize I forgot to mention that while the League of Cities is listed as being willing to come down and testify, I've been authorized to say that they are in full support of this bill as well. They're here for questions, but they don't need to testify.
Any further questions? Anybody from the audience that needs to come down and either speak for or against this bill? Please identify yourself for the tape. And
good morning, Mr. Chairman, members. Mark Anthonson, attorney for the Minnesota Newspaper Association, the Association of All the State's Newspapers. There's nobody, I don't think, who would contest the notion that the author is seeking to advance here, which is that social media are widely used, and the way in which they're used creates a problem for public officials under the open meeting law. Many years ago, the Supreme Court, in its wisdom, created a concept called, and Representative Hansen referred to this, called the serial meeting, which is something that could occur even in those days by telephone calls, where I talk to Councilmember B, and then she talks to Councilmember C, and you have a round robin, which forms an agreement on an issue. That's illegal. It's always been illegal. So the concept here to give public officials some safety zone, some latitude to use social media effectively is fine. In its present form, though, I would just echo some of the issues that Representative Hansen has already expressed. There's just too much room with the present language to allow members of a public body to deliberate, discuss, and decide an issue outside of a public meeting. Mr. Sulem correctly says that the language of the bill provides that it's not intended to replace the public meeting or votes at a public meeting, but you don't want your council meeting, school board meeting, and town board meetings to be ceremonial occasions where people just show up and vote. I mean, that's not good for public information. I don't think, just speaking personally, it's good for the democratic process. You want the debate to occur in the public meeting. And so somehow the notion that public officials can contribute to forums in which the general public is also participating is great. But you've got to have some limitations so that the public officials in the process of using these social media don't essentially decide issues outside of the public view. And we're here, the language of the bill simply says any social media forum can be used if it's generally open to the public. What does that really mean? Who is that? Are older citizens really properly served by that sort of language? So, again, we embrace the goal. We think that the bill needs some considerable work to tighten it up, to clarify some of these concepts before it would be ready to be enacted. Thank you, members.
Representative Freiberg.
I'm just curious, how would you distinguish the situation Representative Quam mentioned? Suppose, I mean, since you represent the newspaper association, suppose you have a city council of five people, a newspaper reporter calls them up individually, asks all of them how they plan on voting on an issue before the city council, and then reports it in the paper, you know, these three council members are voting in favor of this, these two council members are voting opposed to it. I mean, to me, that seems like a public forum as well and can lead to...
Mr. Anfinson.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. Representative Freiberg, the difference is that in the case of the newspaper example, that's simply a poll done by an outside party. The mischief that the open meeting law is designed to avoid is secret deliberations among the members of the governing body with each other or through an intermediary, where decisions are made outside the public view. And that causes a lot of controversy over time across the state. There's an example right now percolating near Rochester at Pine Island, where the new members of the city council, before they were sworn in, apparently got together with one of the existing members and agreed to fire the city administrator. So at the first meeting of the new year in January, a vote is taken with virtually no discussion, and the administrator is fired. That's a big decision, big issue. Now, there's nothing illegal about that, because the members who apparently participated in the decision weren't members of the council yet. But it tends to have a bad effect on public confidence in the process of government, and it's been illegal for many years in Minnesota. There's a way to fix this so that a public, identifiable, familiar forum can be observed by members of the public, and then I don't think the deliberation's a big deal. This bill would not provide the adequate assurance of public access to the deliberations. That's the problem.
Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Affenson, do you have any specific language that would clarify this, or do you have some specific ideas of how this could be tightened up to avoid abuse?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hansen, I have some specific ideas. I don't have specific language. It's a complex... I'm not going to state the obvious. The evolution of social... Oh, I'm not going to emphasize the obvious. The evolution of social media is incredibly complex, and it's only going to continue to evolve. My idea is that if you had a forum or forums of social media that the members of the public body identified and had decided or determined were adequately accessible by the general public whenever they wanted to look at the site, I don't know that there'd be a big deal in allowing the members of the body to contribute comments to that forum. But the current language says any social media forum, and it provides very little assurance that, even though it says it has to be generally accessible to the public, what does that mean?
Representative Quam, would you be willing to work to lay this over and work to try and get language with the newspaper, with the gentleman, and work with the counties to tighten the language up?
For the past year, I have been available, and there have been improvements, and I am definitely open to any work on that.
Because this is going to the general register, so I think I don't want to let it out of here if there's big issues. And
I would think that within a week we would be able to come up with something. I'm definitely open to working on.
And Representative, I'm going to lay this over, and so that and and charge you to work on this and try and get language that we'll all coalesce around, and so that we don't we can get it passed to the floor. Is that okay with you?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members.
And make sure you work with them and get it done.
I will.
The next bill we have, and I understand there's some issues with this, but we'll get started on this, and hopefully we can get these issues done. We can go a little late because nobody's right away behind us, but I move House File 651 to pass, be referred to the Committee on State Government Finance. And Representative Purcell, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I'm happy to have this bill in front of you today, and if I understand correctly, we've got an amendment, and I'd like to...
Well, Representative Purcell, why don't we have Auditor Otto explain the bill, what it's for, and tell us where she feels on the amendment.
Mr. Chair, and would you please tell me how we're going to proceed with this bill in general to move that?
Well, the motion has been made to move it to state government finance, and there's concerns with it, and there's a lot of questions I know on the bill and on the amendment. So, if we could have Auditor Otto, and describe what the bill is quickly and where she stands on the amendment.
Mr. Chair, it would be really helpful if Kent Sulem from MAT could speak on behalf of his members who've requested this, if that's acceptable to the committee.
Mr. Sulem, please identify yourself again for the tape. And
Mr. Chair, members, again, Kent Sulem with the Minnesota Association of Townships. The bill before you is a issue that we've been working with State Auditor Otto on for several months. CTAS is a program that is used by 1,000 of our members, or a little over 1,000 of our members, and approximately 300 of the small cities. The Small Cities Association have also been involved with these conversations. It's at the end of its life. Our members are pleading with us to make sure that it remain available. It's going to cost about $250,000 to do a blanket upgrade so it's compatible with today's computers. It simply isn't working on the new platforms like Windows 8 and that type of thing. And so we'd love if the state could just give us a check for $250,000 or give Auditor Otto a check for $250,000 and we could go ahead and do it. In today's economic times, we realize that's just not a viable option. And so our folks are willing to pay a one-time user fee that would cover the cost of the upgrade. And we anticipate creating a slush fund that could then be used to help with further improvements and enhancements as the things come out. The reason CTAS is so important is that it's tailored to the needs of the small communities. It automatically complies with the reporting systems that we have to do under state law, whereas if you have private sector software, which is certainly an option and other folks are using it, we also have people still doing paper logs. That still remains an option. But by and large, CTAS is the overwhelming preference for our folks in order to have efficiency and effectiveness with their tracking of finances and being able to report our economic statuses to the state as required by statute.
Auditor Otto.
And Mr. Chair, I think Mr. Sulem summarized it quite well. This is a true state and local government partnership. It's accounting software for these local governments. And I'm fine with the delete all amendment. What that does is it actually removes a state appropriation requirement. So this will be funded by user fees by these local governments who use CTAS. So it's only CTAS users and nobody else. It's not a mandatory program. It's optional. We don't intend it on trying to make it mandatory because right now it's been purely voluntary. But it is an efficient program, meets the needs of these entities because it's as much product as they need, and it's an extraordinarily cost-effective software for them. So they requested that we make sure it continues to work on the new operating systems.
Questions? Representative Ruskowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would have a question for Mr. Sulem and maybe Auditor Otto. I was at the recent Wabasha County Township Officers meeting, and there was discussion about this, and there is a wide support for it, although, you know, there's a few that are, you know, somewhat reluctant, but overall very supportive. The understanding, though, is that it's a one-time thing, and I think the language in the original bill or in the underlying bill here reflects that, and I think that's important for them to know, because that's the assumption that they have, at least at this point, that I gathered that night last week. But the amendment doesn't seem to be clear about that being a one-time deal, and then their $300 commitment is done. So I'm wondering what we could do to fix the language in the amendment to accommodate that.
Auditor Otto.
Mr. Chair and Representative Drazkowski, the language right now is somewhat open. We need about 850 CTAS users to pay about a $300 fee right now to get the rewrite done. If we get 1,000 users paying that fee, that's going to be better, because it'll allow for additional revenue that'll be left over once the rewrite's done if it costs about $250,000. That revenue stays in that protected fund in the state accounting system. And it will be used for timely updates. If there's any bugs, the bugs can be worked out. If W-2s change in their format, our staff will be able to go in and make those adjustments, because they'll be written in a platform that will be easy for them to work with. So I guess if and when that pool runs out, those funds, if the group decides they want to do a 10-year annual fee, because we really, it's a partnership, or they want to go to the state and say, can the state put in, you know, $5,000 for some additional work, because you have to maintain the software over time. I guess the hope is, I think within the township community was, well, let's see if we can get more folks using it. That way you have a little additional revenue, and then that pot will last a while for the work we have to do. The good news is we shouldn't have to engage a vendor on those updates like we have to right now, because the software is so old and it's tricky to work with. So does that make sense? I mean, it's for this community, if they said, you know what, we're done now, we don't want to pay anymore, that's what we'll do. Because really, it's a partnership between us. If we don't get enough users to pay the fee, the group might say, you know, we want to pay a little bit bigger of a fee because we want to make sure this thing's around. So there's, right now it's flexible, but I think it's really geared towards the needs of these local governments and what they want, these users, because we're very flexible. For us, it's about meeting the needs that they have, having something that's user-friendly for them. It's extraordinarily cost-effective, but so, yeah.
Representative Drazkowski.
Well, Mr. Chair, I don't have a lot more insight into this other than I don't know that this kind of open ability for them to be charged down the road is what their understanding is, and that's really what I question here, Mr. Chair. And I don't know how to fix the amendment to do that or how to approach it differently, but I do know from the meeting I was in, there were 60 people in the room, and there were a lot of questions about it. And township budgets are not real large, and $300 for them, with the original approach where it was one time, caused some of them pause. So a good number of them pause, but there was still overwhelming support for it because it is so outdated. And thank you, Representative Purcell, for bringing the bill. But for them to have just the ability to be openly charged again down the road, I would encourage us to talk to the members of MAT.
Representative Purcell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Drazkowski, I recalling back to one of our colleagues, Tom Rukavina, Representative Rukavina, and he oftentimes did what you just did and stated for the record what his understanding was, and said that we needed to have that. And I don't know where to put language in here either, the way you're specifying. But statements to that effect, I think, are helpful. I just want to offer that to you, that that's my understanding as well.
And Chair. So we get the bill. The DE-1 amendment is the auditor's amendment. Is that okay? I'll move the House file, or the DE-1 amendment, to House File 651 to get it in the proper order. All in favor of the amendment, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
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 Motion approved. The amendment's adopted. Representative Pepin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think I have similar concerns, but maybe it would be helpful to get a handle on the numbers. Mr. Sulem, I think, said 1,000 townships, and then 320 cities about would be using this?
Mr. Chair, Representative Pepin, that is the information that we have currently. That's approximately 1,000 townships, slightly more than that, I believe, and approximately 300 cities. And we actually are having more and more converts every year as they discover CTAS and the value to it. And if I may just address very quickly the concern we have discussed, you know, that we could insert language, you know, the state auditor may charge a one-time user fee that would clarify it for this go-around. As Auditor Otto indicated, that would then require us to come back for future need or updates. And right now, the way it's structured, if the user fee, if they decide, well, we're going to charge you $3,000 instead of $300, our members are going to say, thanks, but no thanks. We'll do something different, and the program ends. This just creates the flexibility so that they have to put a proposal out to us. We have to say yes. If we say no, then there's no money spent. There's no cost to state. There's no cost to us. So there's a mutual incentive for us to get the program done, but for the auditor's office to keep the price as low as possible, because if they price it out of option, we will be forced to look for something different. Right now, this is the most cost-effective and efficient software for us. So there is a little bit of trust. There's no doubt about that. But it's based on a mutual relationship that what's good for them is good for us, and what's good for us is good for them. And if that trust is broken, everything just ends.
Representative Pepin.
Mr. Chair, I actually have quite a few questions. It's several minutes after committee. I could go forward with my questions if you'd like. I'd rather...
Representative Pepin, are the questions regarding the fee, which would be probably more appropriate in state government finance?
It's some of them. Some of them are about the structure.
Well,
do you want me to just proceed and see where we go? Okay. I guess. Well, what would other government entities be? Would that include counties, or who else might use this? What other government entities might use this?
Auditor Otto.
That's okay, Mr. Chair. Representative Pepin, it's small cities and towns. There could be another small entity. There's many types of local government in Minnesota. So if there are other governmental entities that want to use it, they could, if they're small, because it's really for small government is how it's designed.
I think, Mr. Chair, if I may, I think that language would cover like a joint powers agreement,
yeah.
You know, where you have a joint powers entity, that they're still subject to the same underlying finance reporting requirements, and they could use the software.
Yeah.
But again, it's completely optional. It's not mandated to anyone.
Representative Pepin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. What about port authorities, school districts, those types of local governments?
Mr. Chair, Representative Pepin, I don't think schools, it wouldn't be appropriate for schools because their budgets are much bigger and they'd have more categories of expenditures and revenues than these small entities. This is for really, really small governments that have fairly simple operations. Most products on the market are for more complicated financing structures. So this is, again, for those really small entities. It's totally tailored to them, and they've used it for 20 years. So it's a known product, and it interfaces with our reporting system. So. But no, school, it wouldn't be appropriate. I don't think schools are going to be using it. Port authorities, I don't know that there's any small enough in Minnesota. I think they're more sizable and would need a more complicated type of software.
Representative Pepin.
Okay, thank you. So if we add the townships and the cities together, and I think you mentioned the fee would be something like $300 annually, I'm assuming, one time?
No.
Okay, so that would work out to about 400,000, or maybe a little over 400,000. So that would give you an additional something like 150,000, if my math is correct. Maybe you could just walk me through that special revenue fund and how that would work.
Mr. Chair, special revenue account is in the state's accounting system. And what that does is it protects the fees paid by the users so that it can't plug the state's if there was a deficit or something. It's only for CTAS work. So it gets to be carried forward from year to year and biennium to biennium. The local governments wanted that comfort. We're conservatively estimating that there's 1,000 users that will pay the fee. So that'd be about $300,000. If the rewrite's 250, you have maybe 50 left. Now, let's say that our estimates are wrong and we only get 800. 800 won't be enough to pay the 250,000. At that point, we either have to refund those fees, or the group might say, we need it so badly we're willing to pay a little more. Now, let's say that we get a lot of entities that say, oh, you know, more than, let's say 1,300, they all want to pay it that first year for us to get this work done. You could have additional revenue, but that will be protected within that fund, and that'll just be used over time to maintain and upgrade as we need. And so it's a benefit to them. It's for their use. But we're not sure we're going to get 100% participation in that first year. So, again, we're working with the small cities and the towns. And if they are able to recruit more folks to use it and we get a really high percent of participation, we might be able to bump the fee down. So, really, it's fairly dynamic, but it's to try to make sure that that work gets done.
Representative Ott, or Pepin.
Thank you. I think, you know, that's somewhat helpful. I'm not all that comfortable, to be honest with you, not if you think that you're going to raise enough money in a year, or this first year. I guess I would feel more comfortable if there were a sunset. And also, there's a potential that, you know, maybe you won't run again and it'll be a different auditor. And so I'm not, the language of may charge user fees without a maximum gives me a little bit of heartburn there. I'm not very comfortable with that. So I guess I would prefer if you would, I preferred the original language of the bill, because while I understand you're looking for flexibility, the state auditor may charge user fees. I understand you're saying that they wouldn't pay if it was a certain amount, but it seems like if there was some kind of a cap, then you know, that would just make me more comfortable. And if there was some kind of sunset, and also I'm just kind of on the cost of this, who will be updating the software? Will it be somebody in your office? Will that be someone you contract out, and do you have an estimate on
auditor.
On what it costs going forward, what the software would cost going forward to maintain?
Mr. Chair, Representative Pepin, so we would engage a vendor. We want CTAS users to be part of a working group. We want them to be part of testing that software as it's developed. We usually have user testing. We want to help them with the even, you know, vendor selection. So they'll be pretty involved because this is their product. And we have a rough estimate. We haven't done formal estimates. Rough estimate, $250,000 to rewrite. We're going to get it written in the platform of C#, which our staff can actually work in. So the good news is we can fairly efficiently make small upgrades and maintain the software, hopefully within our staff, which really helps in terms of not having to engage with a vendor over time. It'll help our smaller entities who are relying on that software. So hopefully that answers your question. I think Mr. Sulem actually had a really good point that this is a partnership, and if their members don't like something that the office did, if I was not the auditor, because I'm a very frugal person, and we just have to have enough to get it done, but the towns and small cities could come to you and say something bad has happened, or they simply walk away and say we're not using that product anymore because we can find a much more cost-efficient product. So, you know, I'm not opposed to saying we can't charge fees again. I'd feel more comfortable leaving it to the small cities and the towns if they feel that they need language. But this is these fees are protected in a special revenue account, so they're not going to be, they can't be dipped into for any other purpose, and there's no reason for a lot of money to sit in there short of a pot that can be used over time to make sure we keep that software functioning well for the members that are using it.
Representative Pepin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You know, I'm still not comfortable, and I didn't have an amendment to the amendment ready to go. I actually wasn't even aware of the amendment to the amendment or amendment to the bill. I'm wondering if Representative Purcell, you'd be open to putting a cap on the fee and a sunset on the time, so that it would be clear that it was just a one-time fee.
Representative Pepin, why don't we, it's quarter two and we're 15 minutes over, why don't we lay this over till tomorrow's meeting, and you work, if you can work with Representative Purcell offline to come up with that amendment to the amendment that makes you comfortable, and maybe we can get this done quickly tomorrow morning.
Thank you, Mr.
If that's okay. And Representative Purcell, I'm charging you to do that. And with that, members, we're going to lay House File 651 over for tomorrow. And with that, I've got the other people who's had questions on the list. Hopefully, that'll take care of that. With that, the meeting's adjourned for today.